Chrome was sniffing the air with his enhanced olfactory circuits. Circuits that analyzed every molecule. He could detect a herd of caribou to the south. He would pick one off, carry it, and eat it raw, a little each day. It would be all he needed to fuel his trek. He would range far and wide, off the road. Any pursuers of Keyloth would take advantage of the shortcut the uncharted area held. The clever pursuers would try to cut across the loop that the Alaska Highway made. Roxon would do that. It would be the smart thing to do. The Metal Man had but one compulsion left in him that seethed through his brain. Revenge. Back from the grave he had come, back stronger than ever before. Back to kill the man who had blown him apart. Roxon. Roxon was as relentless as Chrome. If anyone was out there trailing them, it was Roxon. He let revenge seed through his body now, encouraging the circuits linked to what remained of his blood and muscle systems to move more swiftly. Tirelessly, he walked toward his goal, the mountain. Mount Draco. Chrome, when he was but a human soldier for the Empire, had been a skilled mountain climber. But that training in the German Alps hadn't prepared him for the 21,000-foot peak that was Draco. But he wanted to achieve the height of the mountain for surveillance purposes. If he could spot any pursuers, he could perhaps pick them off with the rifle now slung over his shiny metal shoulders. If they were nowhere to be seen, then he could simply set the charges at the top of the mountain and descend. The mountain had masses of snow that would fall from the slightest concussion. Chrome looked around, searching for the right spot. The crevice his electronic scope vision detected halfway up the mountain would do. A small cave-like indentation, just big enough to set the 10 liters of explosives in. He began the climb using pinions only where needed, relying on the enormous strength of his servo-mechanism-driven arms to carry him from fingerhold to fingerhold. The lower slope, full of jagged bare rock outcroppings, was made for a swift climb. At least by an expert such as he. In an hour's time, his steel hands pulled him up and over into the small cave. It was deep enough for Chrome to roll his body into. He unpacked the explosive package and attached the sensing microphone and wires. He did this with speed and efficiency. He was hardly winded by the climb. Chrome exulted in this nearly limitless endurance. He attached the end of the 150-foot rope of nylon braid with a piton he hit deep into the rock, using only his steel fist. He wanted to get down in a hurry, to continue his search-and-destroy mission. He pulled on the rope and made sure it would bear his weight. Then he slid down at a speed that would have burned another's hand. He reached another toehold, steadied himself, and yanked the rope above loose with a tremendous pull. Then he gathered it, inserted another piton in the granite mountain, attached the rope again, and repeated the process. Doing this 10 times, he made the descent in a mere 5 minutes. He turned and pushed a button on his arm that activated the microphone. He would scout west next, and then south. He walked away from the mountain, careful not to make a noise, for the charges were set to go off at the sound of a voice, or a dog's bark, or the tramping of feet. After leaving the ice city, Roxon and his men pushed north into the forbidding area the Eskimos called the Devil's Playground. It was a landscape of twisting canyons and smoking volcanic cones, some hundreds of feet in height. Only the guidance of the ice city men enabled the party to choose the right path to take through the labyrinth of death. The temperature, by the fifth day out, had dropped to a constant minus 45 degrees. They still managed to cover more than 80 miles a day, and by the time they reached a frozen lake, Roxon's sextant indicated they had crossed the 64th parallel. They almost reached the end of the 20-mile-wide lake when there was a sound to chill the most hardened fighter.
Rock, we gotta go.
Yeah. Quickly, cut right to the bank of the lake, into those woods. If we're lucky, there'll be dry wood there. We'll build a fire to keep them away.
The sleds turned as one on the frozen lake and raced in the moonlight toward the shoreline a mile away. Behind them now, dozens of wolves poured out of the night, their gray pelts glistening in the white fire moonlight, their intended victims well visible to their night eyes.
Rock, they're gaining on us!
I know! Mush!
They're still gaining on us.
Archer, get... Shit! Shot pistols out, man. Good shot, McCoughlin.
Yeah, but now they're spreading out.
It doesn't matter. Fire!
Rock saw what appeared to be one of the leaders, a big brown wolf, catching the moonlight far off to the right. As the men continued firing at every opportunity, Rock leapt aboard the sled he had been gliding behind. His added weight further slowed down the team, but it couldn't be helped. He crawled forward over the blankets and felt it, his Liberator rifle. He switched on its laser sight and lay belly down. The sled danced and swerved forward, guided by the panicked dogs. Rock swung the light-sensitive scope around the horizon and found the big brown leader wolf.
There you are.
Next up?
The laser night sight found another, much closer wolf. The huge wolf went straight for his neck. Rock instinctively swung the rifle's butt at the creature's jaws. The teeth embedded instead in his right shoulder. The wolf spun off the side of the sled.
I'll cut your back, Roxon. You take care of that shoulder.
Roxon, who somehow still had his short steel skis locked on, crawled back to the end of his sled. He took his old position, hanging on for dear life as he made contact with the rapidly passing ice beneath him. He was nearly jerked off his feet, but held the handle with a steel grip in his good left hand. Somehow, he managed not to fall. The full weight of his body gone now, the dogs increased speed. Any second, he half expected one of the Husky's hearts to burst. Tinglin pulled alongside him.
Someone's missing! There's only five sleds now!
Oh no.
Behind them, a human and six dogs had been caught. All Rock could see was a mass of wolves jumping and tearing. Something. The wolves have won. At the roaring fire that night, Roxon sat with his head buried in his hands. Peterson was gone. It wasn't the way to die, ripped apart by wolves. But then, there were few ways to go that were particularly pleasant. And the death of Peterson wasn't the only thing troubling the Doomsday Warrior. Robinson had been killed as well. And there was the constant image of Archer. The big lug lay near death, or already dead, back in Ice City. And Rock himself had lost use of his right arm. Farrell, acting the medic again, had made it a sling. The throbbing pain reassured Rock that the arm was still alive, still connected despite the huge teeth wounds. Tinglum rubbed some bear salve in the wounds, and the pain diminished. Dawn came, its fingers of amber light like the hand of a cadaver reaching up for a chance of rebirth. But there was none. Just the barrenness of the dead forest they had camped in. Twisted, gnarled tree trunks and fallen branches, and around it, a white barren wasteland stretching seemingly forever. Sharansky, his plump body withered to gauntness, took another antimatter reading.
How far are we?
We're 4 days hard traveling still. Please, Roxon, let us go back. This is insane. I can't go on.
We go on, buddy. Sorry.
My Drumkin, you Americans, you are mad. Crazy. You are a suicidal race.
Maybe. Maybe we are suicidal, or maybe we just value freedom more than our lives. Now, everybody, we gotta go fast for the next few days. And the only way we can do that is by cutting our load.
Roxon, Peterson already had most of our food in his sled, and now you're saying we have to toss our other luxuries?
And we're pretty much done with luxuries. Except those neon coats you got, Roxon. Those more important than our guns.
Don't be stupid, Detroit. Not only do the coats not weigh much, but we can use them ourselves if we have to. It doesn't matter how much food or guns or equipment we have out here if we freeze to death. All the clothes stay. Stoves have to go.
You're kidding me.
Stoves? I would highly recommend
they're heavy, and we have five of them. I'm just saying we should get rid of four. I'm not happy about it either. But it's better we do this than we get the Kilov too late.
And what about food, Roxon?
Easy. We'll just hunt. Let's see what those three from Ice City can do.
1 hour later, the three returned, a freshly killed young elk with them. McCoughlin prepared a man-sized caribou steak dinner for everybody. to bring their spirits up. The rest of the meat was loaded, a bit to each sled, and after the dogs were fed the gristle and fattier parts, and the bones, they were on their way, fortified. After 3 more days of arduous travel, the cold and weary attack team came directly below the enormous volcanic mountain called Mount Draco. It was a mountain that hadn't existed before the Nuke War. Its towering 21,000-foot summit was loaded with glacial ice. Roxanne had the men stream out their sleds in a long single file as they passed to the west of the sometimes lost in the clouds peak. He wanted the group to make as little noise as possible, for there was the danger of an avalanche. The sleds were nearly beyond the pass and out in the flat snow of the plain again, when the lead dog of Tinglum's sled stepped on a sharp rock.
Roxanne, that sounded like thermite.
Whatever it is, oh shit.
The giant mass of glacial ice on Mount Draco pulled free and started down.
Marsh! Marsh, you husky!
A wall of ice began moving down the slopes above, rushing towards them. The massive cloud of snow dust behind them blotted out the pale Arctic sun. The way grew so dark that they could barely see a thing. The massive wave of snow towered over them. Ahead of them, they saw a herd of caribou charging perpendicular, trying to run to one side of the avalanche. Rock looked to the left of the group and spotted a small blue darkness in the side of a snow slope. It looked like an ice cave.
To the left! Follow me!
Looking back to make sure his men saw his move, Rock saw the awesome 1,000-foot-high wall of snow moving forward. The two sleds closest to the wave were enveloped in powdered snow. Rock rode right by the herd of animals who were working at climbing up a snowdrift. He could see how deep the cave was. They would be safe if they all made it. Rock glanced back and saw the other sleds fly in behind him, right before the avalanche hit the cave entrance.
Rock! I can't see a thing.
I'm here. The snow blocked off our entrance. Here's the flashlight.
Roxanne looked around him and saw that everybody had made it in. Chen, Farrell, Detroit, McCoughlin, Tinglum, Sharansky, and himself were in. The Eskimo guides had made it as well.
Is there another way out of here?
No, I think this is just a cave. We're fine now, but there was only one way out, and we're gonna run out of air soon.
Well, then we'd best start digging. Chen, did you see that herd of caribou?
Yeah. I must admit, I didn't know why you suddenly turned towards them until I saw this cave, too.
Yeah. If we'd have gotten here earlier, the caribou would have blocked our path.
Yeah. But we got here at just the right time. Not only did they run by us as we crossed their path, but it attracted your attention towards this cave.
We would have all died if the shaman hadn't delayed us.
You think he knew?
It's impossible. We'll never know for sure.
Rock, we've dug out.
That's great. Now let's carve up a tunnel for the sleds.
3 hours later, the men had gotten all their equipment out of the small cave. They made sure their dogs and sleds were okay, and then set off again. Roxanne and the others were silent. The sun, which had been edging over the horizon, sank. The northern lights came on like a neon sign, sending blue-green curtains across the starlit sky. On and on they plunged into the near-endless darkness of the forbidding Northlands. After a brief rest stop, they spent the next 12 hours speeding across an enormous flat expanse. It grew colder by the hour. It was down to almost minus 40 degrees, and was still dropping by the time they joined together 3 tents and crawled into the shelter. They huddled close to the seal oil heater that was their life giver. But they were short of precious fuel, and it had to be used sparingly. Chen and McCoughlin had frostbitten feet. Roxanne was deeply worried about them. But nothing could be done except to try to keep the flesh as warm as possible and move the injured tissue often to keep the blood circulating.
I took a sextant reading before we got in. We're just 5 miles from the Arctic Circle. Sharansky will be in here soon. He's packing up the antimatter meter.
How far is he, Sharansky?
I had to check the meter twice to make sure it wasn't malfunctioning. He's only 6 miles away. He hasn't moved since our last reading.
At last. All right. If he hasn't moved for so long, we're gonna have to assume that he's chosen his location for launching his missiles. From here, he's close enough to hit both Russia and Colorado. Let's get some rest. We're attacking tomorrow.
They set off on skis, moving quickly over the rolling terrain. The weather was good, and they could steer by the faint light of the stars. A few miles on, Rock's calculations were proven correct. They had intersected the Alaskan Highway. They saw it when they crested a tundra hillock. Snow-covered, a long, smooth roadway stretching back toward the southwest.
Look, there are tire tracks from large vehicles in the snow.
Let's check it out. I'd say these were made less than a day or two ago. I see them. A few miles up, there's a row of structures. Let's get up the hill again, under better cover behind those rocks. We'll take a look from there.
A scan of the base with the high-powered light amplification lenses showed that the KGB force was busy as bees, constructing Quonset-type buildings, guard towers, and the like. There were lots of troops down there, possibly 100.
The trailer with the large radio antenna jutting from it must be Kilov's headquarters. It's right in the middle of the base.
Yeah, I see it. What are those men doing out on the plains, just stomping around?
It's, they're flattening the ground. It might be for an airstrip. If he's expecting planes, we have to move fast. Once this fort's done being built and he's brought in additional troops by air, we may not be able to stop him.
Further scanning showed the trucks, 10 of them, that had carried the troops, and 5 large balloon-tired vehicles, presumably the ones that had carried the missiles.
Those missile trucks aren't carrying anything anymore.
There are those 5 huts, though. See if you can see anything in them.
Yeah. There's one in each hut.
Do you see the hinges at one side of the roof of each of the huts? They open up like a cigar box. The missile pops up on its launcher arm and is fired. Those are the standard field bunkers for the missiles. The launch crew, 4 men to each missile, stay inside the building until launch, of course, which requires a 4-minute countdown.
I might have some good news. Remember the oil shortages of the 20th century? How a great pipeline was built by you Americans through Alaska and through part of the Yukon to carry oil from the north southward?
Yes. What's that got to do with attacking Kilov?
Roxon, when you again scan with your binoculars, don't fail to notice the slight bump in the terrain. It cuts diagonally through the compound. Difficult to see at first. That bump, if I'm not mistaken, is the covered-up pipe of your ancestors, Roxon. Empty, I hope.
If it is the old pipeline, it used to be mostly above ground, as I recall from the history books. So someplace back to the south, it must still break the surface. There's no way of telling, though. And a lot of it could have collapsed. But we'll give it a try. I think I remember reading it was big enough to walk through. Chen, we still have the cutting torches, don't we?
Yes. No food left, no heating oil. But thank God we managed to hold on to the torches.
Then we'll use the pipeline as a highway right into the camp. It's probably very close to the surface there, hence the bump. Kilov has no reason to believe he was pursued. We have the element of surprise. They think they are protected well by their razor-wire electric barriers.
There's a storm brewing in the east. It will bring a good blow and lots of snow for cover in a few hours.
Detroit, I want you to equip 5 of us with stun grenades. We don't want a big explosion near those missiles. And you, Sharansky, you know that Kilov is here this far north because he wants to be in range of Moscow. We have to defuse those missiles. There can't be any mistakes.
It is my country's life. My country's history that is at stake. There will be no mistakes, Rox, and I promise you that.
They made good time despite a gathering snowstorm. Soon they reached the gigantic rusty pipe jutting out of the tundra. It was perhaps 8 feet in diameter. It looked solid enough.
It's true. There it is.
The northern gods have provided our salvation. And they have provided us a storm to hide the noise when we cut out of the pipe in Kilov's camp.
If they really cared about our salvation, They wouldn't have sent the Sasquatch or the wolves or that boiling sauna or that avalanche or the...
That's enough. Let's get to work.
They broke out torches and set about cutting a man-sized hole in the pipe.
All right, step back.
It's empty. We can travel inside.
The 20th century steel alloy had held up pretty well. Rock played the light down the seemingly endless interior. It looked like it hadn't collapsed anywhere.
Sharansky, can you set the antimatter cell?
Already done. We're so close to them that the thing would practically melt if I turned it on. I adjusted its sensitivity so it doesn't ping until we're almost on top of the missiles.
Good. McCoughlin, you're in charge of carrying it.
Right.
Everybody in.
When they were all safely in the shelter of the 8-foot-wide oil pipe, the men huddled around Sharansky, who opened the diagram of the deadly missile. Roxon played his flashlight beam onto the diagram.
There won't be time for Sharansky to defuse all 5 missiles. The Major will instruct us all how to do it.
For a precious half hour, Sharansky explained. Detroit, McCoughlin, Chen, Farrell, and Roxon caught on. But the 3 Eskimo guides stared in bewilderment. The instructions brought a blank expression to Tinglum's face as well. Rock decided then and there that there would be 5 two-man teams.
One man will protect while the other works on the missile. We use stun grenades to knock out the bunker crews. The grenades won't cause enough shock to blow the missiles up. Now, the Major has shown you how to open the missile's wiring sections. Each missile is identical. And install the antimatter drains. The teams will be Farrell and Dalmak, McCoughlin and Zeebach, Chen and Ngaikuk, Detroit and Tinglum, and Sharansky and me. If any team doesn't make it, another will rush and finish the job.
They started walking in the pipe. Each had a liberator and enough ammo for a few minutes of firefight. Their shock pistols were nearly empty. 10 cold and tired men against about 100 fanatical KGB commandos. Not good odds. But Roxon had faced odds nearly as bad in the past and survived. Sharansky was a little weak-kneed at the idea of the unfair odds, and had to be encouraged along the interior of the pipe. It was an hour and a half before the meter picked anything up.
We're within proximity to one.
Finally. What time is it?
11 a.m. hereabouts.
Give it another hour. By then, the storm should be at its maximum.
They sat there, as tense as they had ever been in their lives. At noon, they started cutting through. A rolling mess of tundra mixed with snow came tumbling in, but the flow quickly stopped. They could see the glow of a searchlight. The howling winds had covered their cutting noise. A fierce storm, ice and snow, frigid wind, was blasting across the frozen land, making for a near whiteout condition. The searchlight that lit the camp merely reflected off the milky, swirling snow.
Leave the searchlight alone unless we're detected. Once the shooting starts, knock it out.
Roxon and the others clawed up into the frozen camp, into the numbing cold of the black day. Each man knew exactly what he was supposed to do. Rock and Sharansky made the first run from the hole, right after the beam of the searchlight swept past. They made a dash for the closest bunker. They hit the snow 10 feet from the bunker door and watched the 4 other teams make their own runs to the other bunkers. In seconds, they were all in place. Rock rose, pushing Sharansky forward. They ran right up to the bunker door. A light was coming through a crack in the metal doorway.
Here goes nothing. Let's go!
The 2 attackers entered the smoking interior, stepping over stunned bodies.
There's the missile. Sharansky, get to it.
The Major rushed forward with his red deactivator box and got to work. Roxon stripped off his parka and put on the least messy red uniform coat. Rock spotted a squad of KGB caught in their own searchlight's beam.
Hurry up, dammit!
I am hurrying!
Sharansky was dripping cold sweat as he carefully placed the Phillips screwdriver into the first screw head and loosened it. He knew he'd do it right, but Detroit, Shent, McCaughlin, and Farrell were doing the same thing with very little instruction in the other bunkers. If any one of them made a mistake, they'd all be vaporized instantly, along with 250 square miles of Arctic wasteland. The Major loosened the second screw. Then, with a solid grip on both screws, he pulled them out simultaneously. He removed the cover, exposing the wiring, took the red box, and jammed it into place.
Done!
Let's go!
Rock grabbed his parka as they scrambled out of a side window. When the beam of the searchlight had passed, they ran like jackrabbits out into the drifting snow, back toward their rendezvous with the others, the pipe hole. Seconds after they dove into the cover of the cut-open pipe, the beam of the searchlight passed again. Seconds stretched to hours, minutes stretched to eternity as they waited for the other free fighters.
Detroit, you made it!
Our target is neutralized.
Chen is...
And Guy Cook was hit. I've been carrying him back. I think he'll be okay.
McCaughlin, where...
They got Zeebok. Farrell and Dalmock, too. I saw them lying in the snow outside the fifth bunker.
Did they defuse the missile?
I don't know.
Sharansky, you come with me. The rest of you, cover us. And for God's sake, get that searchlight.
What a great diversion that was. Such luck to have found a screamer like this, too. What?
Kilov ran to the window.
There must be an entire squadron of fighters out there. I knew it! I knew Roxxon was following me! Damn it! They shot out the spotlight!
Move! Stop shooting at everything that moves! Turn on the vehicle's headlight! See what you are doing! Beware of damaging the missile!
Roxxon and Sharansky took advantage of the ceasefire order to rush for cover behind some crates. Following Kilov's orders, the KGBers began turning on their headlights. The free fighters knew what to do. In a matter of moments, the lights had been shot out again. Rock and Sharansky had to get to the last bunker.
This is Kilov contacting Bunker 3. Bunker 3, please respond. This is Kilov contacting Bunker 4. Bunker 4, please respond. This is Kilov contacting Bunker 5.
This is Bunker 5 responding.
Oh, fire the missile! Now! We're under attack!
But, dear, where should...
It's already target programmed!
Initiating launch sequence now. T-minus 60 seconds.
This is Kilov. Get me General Sokovnik.
Kilov, you are alive? Where are you?
I am in the Yukon. Zero in on my broadcast. I have constructed a short runway. Send a rescue jet right away. A fast, short takeoff and landing plane. My base is under attack.
Colonel Kilov, I cannot. Vasily has given orders that you are a traitor and anyone helping you would be executed.
If the rescue plane is not here in 20 minutes, I will inform Vasily that you were part of my doctor's plot to kill him. As a matter of fact, you are the last conspirator yet alive. Send two planes. One to land and pick me up. One to fly escort. Do you understand what I say, you fool? Unless that plane picks me up.
Yes, they will be sent, Excellency. Two of my fastest jets, 20 minutes at most.
Finally. It's so hard to get good help.
Kilov staggered to his closet, put on a parka, and ran out through the hole that had appeared in the side of the trailer. He ran for his life as tracer bullets lit up the air behind him. Then he heard a rumble, saw the missile rising on its column of flame. The bunker crew had obeyed his order.
Death! Mega death for Century City!
Rock watched the deadly missile roar aloft with a despair he had never felt before in his life. He desperately directed rifle fire up at the ascending thing. But it climbed too fast. It headed away. In a matter of seconds, the Swift cruise missile was out of range, and he realized it was heading south, toward the U.S., not toward the Soviet Union. His men were still engaged in a deadly firefight with overwhelming KGB forces. But for what purpose now?
Withdraw! Withdraw! There's no reason to stick around now! Get to the pipe! Get the hell out of here!
He was about to do the same when he saw a figure running out of the trailer. Kilov. He was heading toward the runway. Kilov must have a plane coming in. Rock abandoned his effort to leave the hellish killing field. He had to catch Kilov. Had to wring his scrawny neck. At least that would be something. It was 200 yards to the airstrip. Stumbling over dead KGBers, he zigzagged, avoiding a trail of bullets. Rock was determined not to lose the man. In quick time, he made it to the tarmac. He'd cut off Kilov. Roxon pulled his shot pistol up to the ready and waited, concealed by a pile of construction supplies at the edge of the snowblown tarmac. A shape. A huge shape, silhouetted against the raging fires back in the camp, confronted him. It wasn't human, that was certain. Its half-torn-away uniform revealed glistening chrome and steel parts. It was 7 feet tall, if an inch, and it stepped out in front of Roxon and blocked his way.
Roxon, you die here.
Rock didn't know who, or rather what, the man-machine was, but he had no time to waste. The man-machine just stood there. Its gleaming chrome steel chest was undamaged, though stripped of cloth by the X pattern of shot pellets. The thing should have been blasted to bits, but it stood.
I said you'd die here, Roxon.
Who are you? How do you know my name?
You killed me, Roxon. Yet I live.
Don't speak in riddles, pal. Who are you?
Gunther used to be my name. You killed me in the Battle of Forster Valley. But I was recreated, Roxon. And now I am a superior being. They call me Chrome. I am invincible. You die here.
Roxon caught a glimpse of Kilov, silhouetted briefly in the fire from the camp. The man had reached the opposite side of the runway, and he was crouching there now, gleefully watching the standoff between Roxon and Chrome.
My rescue jet will soon be here, but I have a ringside seat while I wait to watch your death, Roxon. Please, don't kill him too fast, Chrome. Amuse me until I must go.
I will amuse. Watch.
No.
Time to die, Roxon.
Rock dove toward something he saw jammed into the tundra a few feet away. A substitute weapon of a sort. He grabbed the handle of the thing. It was a pneumo pick. A pick of the type you use to dig up concrete. Powered by a small fuel cell in the handle. When used, the tip of the pick glowed with white heat. The tool was designed to vibrate and burn its way deep into the ground. Surely it could do some damage to this junk heap confronting him. Rock hefted the big pick in his hand. Chrome just stood there, waiting. Rock wondered if Chrome might be slow. Maybe. In that case, he could just run around the metal man. No use fighting if he could just dodge the damn monster. He had to get Kilov. Chrome moved toward the Doomsday Warrior through the swirling blur of snow that continued to pile up around them. Roxon hefted the pneumo pick. He braced it against his forearm, knowing that to do any real damage to his enemy, he would have to strike quick, hard, and often. Only a scratch showed on the metal skin.
You waste your time, human.
Roxon saw some patches of ice and moved in that direction. Maybe the cyborg would slip on the ice. Roxon dodged the wildly grasping metal arms and thudded the business end of the pick against Chrome's shoulder. The cyborg had braced for the attack and didn't even budge. Chrome reached forward with incredible speed and caught Roxon's injured right shoulder. Roxon's world became pain. Too immediate, too real to allow him to worry about anything else. Chrome maintained an even pressure, his fingers never tiring. He wanted to tear the puny human shoulder, crush the clavicle and its surrounding deltoid muscles. But that would be all too easy. There would be no fun in that for Colonel Keeloff, who had instructed Chrome to kill Roxanne slowly. Roxanne's mind swam through the pain clogging his system, looking for a way out of his situation.
Shall I kill you now, human Roxanne?
Rock hooked his left foot behind the cyborg's right.
Maybe. Maybe not just fucking yet, pal.
Rock rolled away as they fell. The metal fingers closed only on torn fabric. But before he had even stopped rolling, Chrome was on his feet, circling the ice to finish Roxanne off. Rock dove across the ice patch, sliding to the pneumo pick, and grabbed it with his left hand.
Get up, human. Get up so I can tear your fingers off and feed them to you one bloody little human lump at a time.
Rock looked at his opponent, trying to find a weak spot. Maybe the joints. Rock swung his pneumo pick and drove it into Chrome's left knee joint with all the force he had.
Gotcha, you bastard!
Pressing his advantage, Roxanne drove the pick forward again and again, guided only occasionally by the flashes of fire from a can. Roxanne varied his attack this time. Roxanne tried every joint he could find, swinging at the waist, the knees, the flat plating over the ribs, but nothing gave. By now, Chrome's uniform was in shreds, only flapping tatters remained. The pick scorched half a dozen of the cyborg's joints. Chrome stood up, and Rock noticed that his left arm now dangled uselessly. The fingers and wrist would not respond. Their pulleys snapped. From the elbow down, the arm had been rendered useless. He had been hurt.
Very good, human. Very efficient. You have damaged me. I never thought to see the day.
Chrome moved forward solidly, swiftly, his one good arm reaching, searching under those cold yellow computer eyes. Roxanne stepped back, but could not dodge the running onslaught of the metal man. He tried to bring the pneumo pick to bear again on his foe, but it was torn from his hands. Chrome fingered it in his still operational hand, twirling the heavy tool as if it were a baton.
This was your salvation, human. Your only hope. Now you have no hope.
Roxanne slammed against machine parts and shards of broken plastic. Blood filled his mouth, flowing from the spot where he had again bitten his tongue on impact. Dazed, he stumbled down the heap, looking for anything he might use against the cyborg. He wouldn't give up. He wouldn't sink into oblivion without one more try. But Chrome was already there. Reaching out, Chrome caught hold of Roxanne's previously injured shoulder and again squeezed. The cyborg lifted Roxanne high into the air.
Shall I kill him now?
Yes! Yes! Kill Roxanne!
Roxanne could fight no longer. The pain overtook him, forgetting Keeloff, even Chrome, the weeks of cold winter weather, the endless nighttime, the loss of men and beasts to the trip.
Pitiful meat thing. You lay in the dirt, your eyes filled with water. I will stomp you like a bug.
Rock wasn't listening. He inched to the side. He had spotted a cable just a few feet away, sticking from the debris. Maybe it could be used as a whip or something. Chrome seemed to have some unexpected difficulty lifting his foot. One of the knee joints Rock attacked had balked. Roxanne suddenly felt that strange mutant's luck feeling in his gut, the same feeling that had guided him in many times of crisis. With his last energy, he wildly rolled to the side. Rock ripped the cable in both hands, ignoring the pain, got into a crouch, and pulled. Under the mound of trash was a heavy block-and-tackle-style pulley dangling from Rock's cable. Grinning, Roxanne staggered to his feet, starting to swing the thing over his head.
Okay, now for round three.
The metal man twisted from the impact, sparks flying from his right eye. Roxanne attacked over and over, raining weighted blows on the metal man's face, trying to get the eyes protected by Chrome's good hand. His shoulder was just pure agony, but he ignored it. Roxanne kept him at bay with the cable and pulley, and the eyes started sparking, then flames shot from them. But the cyborg reached and caught the end of the cable with his good hand. Roxanne was instantly jerked from his feet. Rock was dragged toward the cyborg. Before he got too close, he let Chrome have the cable. As he got up, Chrome ran for him. Good fist cocked back. Rock fell, coughing out phlegm and blood. The blow had been quick, strong. The pain knifing through his side was unbearable. Chrome stalked him, carefully.
Roxanne! Roxanne!
Rock lay still, not able to move. He had escaped the grasp of the cyborg, only to find he could do little more than crawl. He waited for the moment when Chrome would end his life. Perhaps the metal man would kick him to death, or crush his head in his big hand. This was it. But the cyborg walked right by him. Rock realized its eyes were damaged. Roxanne silently got to his feet, keeping his eyes on Chrome. The metal man turned, inadvertently showing his foe what had happened. The pulley had crushed the metal grids over Chrome's eyes. Although he was able to guide himself with his internal movement radar, he could not distinguish one immobile object from another. Roxanne touched his ribs.
There you are.
Chrome crossed half the 30-foot distance between himself and Roxanne and listened intently for any more sounds the man might make. Roxanne didn't dare move. To his left, Rock spotted an oil drum 10 feet away. The noise distracted Chrome, and Rock ran for a mound of debris. The cyborg's head tilted up when Rock dislodged something. It started climbing, sure-footed, swiftly. Rock was some 30 feet above the metal man. He looked in vain for some weapon the snow-covered trash might yield him. The only thing he had left to throw at Chrome was his own body. Then Rock knew. Chrome had human arrogance, human cruelty. He had a human brain. And a brain is connected to a body by the spine, at the back of the neck. Bracing himself, Roxanne tried to judge the distance between himself and the cyborg, then hurtled himself downward at his foe feet first. Chrome didn't hear it coming. Roxanne slowly got to his feet, trying to protect his shattered ribs. He looked back at the cyborg, expecting him to turn and finish him finally. But it was lying crumpled on the ground, its joints flailing weakly. Its mouth opened and closed, but no sound came out. Snow blew into the exposed and broken circuitry in the back of the neck. Sparks shot out. Chrome settled down into a frozen pose so twisted that Roxanne knew the metal man had been wrong. Chrome could feel pain. And Chrome could die. The jet sent to rescue Kilov came in like a bat out of hell, low over the ice, its landing lights flooding the makeshift airstrip. Kilov waved and jumped up and down as the jet bumped down the tarmac and its tires caught, and it reversed power on its two immense ramjet engines.
Here! I am here!
Already the cockpit was opening. When he climbed atop the wing, a hand assisted Kilov up into the cockpit's second seat.
Now go! Go, now!
What? Another jet?
Inside the second jet, Lieutenant Meenhoff hit the brakes. He was confused. Was it he that was supposed to land and rescue Commander Kilov? Or was it Dursky? He wasn't sure, so he had made the decision to land, reasoning that if he was wrong, he could always take off again. And if his plane was supposed to pick off Kilov, he'd better do it. It was the wrong decision.
Here! Over here!
Meenhoff saw a figure running towards him. It was a good thing he landed.
That's Devanya, comrade.
Wait, you're not...
Rock ripped the helmet and dangling oxygen mask from the man's face and threw him off the wing with a powerful heave. Roxanne donned the helmet and assumed the still warm leather seat.
All right, now what?
He frantically looked about the Russian-labeled buttons, switches, and dials of the control panel. He felt the stick. He had studied Soviet planes. The Free Fighters had most of the blueprints back in Century City, the result of a vast network of spies who had infiltrated Soviet fortresses throughout the United States. Rock's near-photographic memory struggled to figure out which instrumentation he was facing. In a flash, he realized he was staring at the control panel of an Ilkin 33 trainer jet. Of course, that's why it had two seats, one for the novice pilot. Trainer jets were easier to fly, and they had computers to take over and correct deadly mistakes. Sometimes voice-activated computers. If only he could turn it on, or even find the damn thing. There were two red switches, labeled 1 and 2 over to the left. A precious minute had already gone by. He had to do something.
Here goes nothing.
Activated flight sequence, automatic.
There was a chance. He had flown a computer-assisted jet once before. The details of the control panel, most of which had no identification on its massive switches and meters, came to him. But his heart sank as he realized something. This was an older model Mach 3 Soviet training jet. It was a jump jet, not built for immense speed, but for short takeoffs and landings. The Doomsday Warrior found the ignition switch to the far right.
Instructions?
Rock looked at the radar and spotted two blips. One was Kilov's jet, the other was the missile. There wasn't really any choice. He'd have to get Kilov another day.
Plot and commence intercept course on missile. Radar screen vector 8.
Refused.
Fire all weapons when missile is in range.
Refused.
How long before intercept?
1 hour, 4 minutes.
Great. Over what area of North America?
Latitude 44 degrees north, 113 degrees west.
Project map of area.
A second screen lit, and a map showed a blinking red dot in the middle of Idaho, close to Denison City, a Free Fighter town of 20,000 souls. The antimatter explosion would destroy Denison.
Computer, can we intercept missile 50 miles further north, over the high mountains?
Only by lightning alone.
Explain, what can be dumped?
Only weapons are available for dump.
Shit. Computer, do we have to drop all weapons to increase speed to intercept missile 50 miles north of intercept point projection?
We'll calculate.
According to Sharansky, the missile warhead would make a 5-mile crater, and its blast effect would be felt 45 miles from the explosion. Rock had to destroy it far over the barren mountains north of Denison somehow.
Calculated. All but one air-to-air missile must be dropped now to enable craft to intercept missile at new designation.
Drop all but one air-to-air weapon.
The plane seemed to gain some speed. The red dot showing intercept location started slowly crawling north on the projected map. Rock wanted to put some more space between the explosion and Denison.
Can we get more speed to intercept the missile?
Not possible at this altitude.
Change altitude to obtain maximum possible speed.
The jet dove with heart-stopping suddenness. In seconds, they were through the clouds and screaming straight at the ground. Seconds later, Rock gaped. They were about 20 feet off the frozen tundra, moving at 2,876 kilometers per hour.
Show new intercept point.
The screen showed the red dot intercept location point creeping north to 80 miles north of Denison. Barren high plateaus. But then something unpleasant had just crossed his mind.
Computer, how close do I have to be to fire air-to-air missile at target?
32 kilometers.
So that's... shit, 20 miles. So we'll be in range of the explosion?
Affirmative.
Continue on course. Fire when in range.
He let himself relax in the seat, a relaxation born of the knowledge that he was as good as dead. At least it would just be him. His mind seized on rambling regrets. Simple things, like the fact that he'd never get to give Rona and Kim their neon rabbit fur robes. But maybe the Rock team would take them back and hand them to the women, and say Rock had bought it for them. Sort of a last gift. A last memory. Outside the cockpit, Buttes and Mesa Rock were going by on all sides like blades of a fan. The jet maneuvered automatically to the left or right with incredible timing to avoid them, like a steel needle through a garment of solid rock. He glanced at the clock, ticking off his time left on Earth. 11 minutes to intercept. Major Mernick was staring at the Montana Air Defense radar screens. He had been in the subterranean monolith war room ever since Kilov, who'd been thought dead, had called on air-to-ground radio from above Canada. Mernick had been dragged out of the bathtub and given Kilov's order.
Roxon is heading into western Montana airspace, pursuing a cruise missile. He must be stopped. Scramble all interceptors. Prepare anti-air missiles. Shoot down any aircraft entering your airspace.
But Roxon should have been here by now. Mernick wished he knew more about this cruise missile Kilov talked of. If it was coming close enough to the base to appear on the screen, the base itself was probably in danger. Yet as much as he feared the missile, he feared Kilov more. He lit another cigarette and stared at the sweep hand of the radar screen. There was the cruise missile, moving at great speed, heading due south. The minute Roxon appeared on the screen, the interceptors, which could go 4,500 kilometers per hour, twice as fast as most jets, would be scrambled into the air. The six fighters were stocked with air-to-air missiles. They had excellent pilots. Kilov's orders would be carried out. Another blip appeared at the edge of the screen. He waited for it to reappear, but it didn't.
What the hell? What happened to Blip 2?
It's flying incredibly low, Major. Too low for the screen to pick it up sometimes. It's on approximately the same course as that missile, 8 minutes behind it.
Call the interceptor squadron. Get them airborne. Tell them to fly high, find the jet, and dive down and finish it off.
Computer, who's coming up on me?
Six Soviet interceptors. MiG 89. Speed 4,500 kilometers per hour.
Damn, that's twice my speed.
Roxon pulled the stick back and rose straight up. He had to destroy the missile, but to do so, he had to survive the dogfight that was about to commence. And to do that, he needed to be above them, not below them. The jet shot upward at a 70-degree angle. He felt so tired, every bone in his body aching from the accelerations and the pressure changes the plane had put him through, from the tension of flying between ground obstacles, from the torturous fight with Chrome. But he had to control the pain, push it aside for later. Century City's entire existence depended on it.
MiG 89, 37 miles away.
He pointed the jet directly at the blinding white sun above. The pursuing jets, though not reliant on visual contact to fire their air-to-air missiles, needed a radar lock on him. Rock would give their air-to-air missiles a choice of two heat sources now. One was the engine of his jump jet. The other was the greatest heat, light, and radar source in the solar system, the sun.
Incoming missile. Six fingers fired.
But the burning sun misled them. The six Soviet missiles came screaming by Roxon's jet, bent on destruction. They roared up toward the stratosphere. They would expend their fuel long before they were even 10 miles further. They'd never reach their target 92 million miles away. Roxon banked the jet into a long rolling dive perpendicular to the radar indications of the six jets, which were breaking formation. Roxon couldn't hope to match the six interceptors in speed or firepower, or even pilot skill. But the trainer jet he was in had one small advantage. It could biff. Most short takeoff and landing jets could do it. To biff meant that Roxon could slow his airspeed by putting the engine on a tilt. As a result of the engine tilt, the forward speed was reduced to subsonic, and then could rapidly drop to zero. A pursuing jet without the biff capability would zoom past and present its butt to Roxon's short-range guns. Roxon hit the takeoff position switch on the engine and felt the dizzying sensation of coming to a near full stop in midair. The nearest interceptor jet zipped past on his port wing. Its startled pilot, expecting this to be more of a turkey shoot than a dogfight, twisted his head around to near breaking point. His target had vectored at an impossible 45-degree angle and dropped behind. He began a long curve and dropped to come around. Too late. He was in Roxon's sights.
All right.
Two more interceptors got his tail. Rock almost sickened himself with a series of barnstorming stunts, rolls, biffs, and dives that none of the five interceptors left could match. Soon they were scattered among the clouds for 100 miles, and since they had no visual sighting, and their radar at ranges greater than 5 miles couldn't tell an interceptor from a jump jet like Roxon's, their eager pilots locked onto the closest targets. Two blips fell from Rock's screen.
Ready to go.
Roxon watched the three remaining interceptors on his radar, slid his jump jet into a swift descent, and dove into a narrow canyon. Hopefully they'd have a tough time picking him up on the radar with all the metallic rocks around.
Shit!
Missile incoming.
The missile flew right past him and straight into the canyon wall. A few rounds of cannon fire whizzed past his cockpit and chipped holes into the Splendor racing by. But they were shooting blind, Roxon's jet's exhaust heat often hidden behind towering pillars of sandstone. He zigzagged between two buttes, almost clipping one.
How many are after me?
One. Radar shows two dead ahead. Circling exit.
Great.
Roxon saw his chance, and he took it. The MiG flew right by Rock, whose finger was on the trigger. Without its port wing flap, the MiG barrel rolled at an incredible speed. The Soviet pilot had a good view of a particularly brightly striated mesa, dotted with sagebrush, glowing in the pink winter sunset, before he hit it. Rock biffed to a stop and set down his jet on a sandy beach-like area, where the roaring creek in the canyon made a gentle turn. Rock hoped that this desperate trick would work. It better. He was a sitting duck now. The first and third MiG pilots saw the explosion of their air buddy's plane down in the canyon. And their computers fooled them. The Soviet interceptor's computers found no trace of the exhaust heat of any aircraft below. The two remaining Soviet pilots sighed in relief. Their comrade had made the supreme sacrifice. His jet had, no doubt, run into the Doomsday Warrior's jet. They peeled away, climbing high, then took a vector back toward base to report their victory. Roxon watched them disappear on his radar. His joy was short-lived. He was alive. But the Magon 2 missile was still heading for Century City.
Computer, prime for vertical takeoff.
Engine
still at
55 degrees.
Afterburners.
He rose quickly out of the canyon on a tower of blue flame, and then he angled off to the south, narrowly missing the lip of the canyon as he gained speed and altitude back on the chase. 7 minutes. The whole air battle had only taken 7 minutes, but that meant that the missile was 7 minutes closer to destroying all that Roxon lived for.
Missile has diverted west if you're content on coming cumulonimbus cloud.
If this jet goes straight through that storm, can we make up 7 minutes of flight time and intercept missile at last point projected?
Yes. But tolerance of this jet is exceeded by projected winds and storm ahead.
Proceed shortest way to target.
Proceeding.
Ahead, Roxon saw the flashing lightning. A brewing blue-black thunderhead appeared directly in front of his jet. He knew the storms with the blue-black clouds packed tornadoes. This could tear the plane apart like a matchstick. The Doomsday Warrior plunged his jet into the hellish turbulence nevertheless. Immediately, the plane began yawing violently from side to side. He trimmed the flaps and the craft steadied. He watched the radar. The missile was there, off to the west. He flew onward into the sodden clouds that buffeted and rocked the little jet like it was a fly caught up in a giant's hand. Blue crackling ball lightning attached to his little craft crept up the wing and flashed itself out.
Oh shit! Where's that aux power switch?
In the faint amber glow, Roxon spotted the altimeter. The hand was spinning too fast to read.
Computer, restart! Computer, restart! Where's the fucking restart button?
Bursts of de-icing fluid exuded from his wings. His seat moved back. A panel rolled back to reveal a first aid kit.
Finally! 4,000 feet!
Danger. Altitude 3,000. I'm calling. 2,000. 1,000. 1,500. 2,000. Resuming previous altitude.
Computer, project our position.
Latitude 45 degrees 18 minutes north. Longitude 114 degrees 1 minute west. Missile is 34 kilometers away. 110 kilometers until desired intercept point.
A sudden drop in air pressure threatened to smash the jet down, and more lightning streaked across the sky. Roxanne fought with the stick. The plane was like a leaf in an autumn squall, rocking, plummeting, and then, amazingly, the storm ended as quickly as it had begun.
Activate afterburners.
Pilot warning A.
At a speed that was heating the wingtips white hot, he tore across the now flat sagebrush-dotted prairie, sending up a sandstorm of dust in his wake, shattering the ears of 1,000 woodland creatures, creating avalanches from the echoing concussion of his passage in the nearby hills. A race against the total destruction of free man. A race to save the world from the clutches of the drug-crazed Colonel Kilov. One man with one air-to-air missile. One desperate man with but one last chance to save humanity.
Emergency abort. B2 grade for structural integrity of plane. Automatically slowing airspeed.
Override! Override! Manual speed control!
Negative. Slowing to Mach 2.
Oh no, you don't! Yes! Yes!
Warning.
You will.
That's better. Afterburners.
Through the vibrations, Roxon took the stick and increased altitude. He leveled off at 6,500 feet, keeping his eyes peeled ahead and the stick held tightly in both hands. The plane's wingtips glowed white. Heat began seeping into the cockpit. The plane was about to disintegrate. He looked at the radar screen. He was less than a kilometer from range. Suddenly, he saw the missile. Off the distance, he saw a flare of light rising over. A mountain. Perhaps it could absorb some of the blast.
I'm in range.
Rock watched his one air-to-air missile shoot forward in a blaze of smoke. Immediately he biffed to slow the jet before it crashed directly into the mountain. In the corner of his eye, he saw a piece of the port wing fly off. Roxon continued staring straight ahead, trying to see past the mountain.
Come on.
Over the mountain came a perfect point of brilliant light, a second sun. The point blew out, creating a perfect sphere 10 miles high. The Earth itself was thrown into contrast, nothing but blinding white and endless long shadows of nothingness. The ball of light hovered there in the air, contrails of blue rippling across its surface, arcs traveling up towards the atmosphere. Then, as if by its own volition, the sphere collapsed in on itself, sucking matter and clouds towards its center. A second later, nothing of the missile remained. Then came the concussion.
Shit! Eject! Eject!
Roxon shot out of the flaming jet, seeing it fall apart as it flew straight for the mountain. Rock unbuckled his chute and looked around. He had survived. The antimatter missile had been destroyed. He started south, walking towards Century City. It was hundreds of miles away, but he had some daylight left, and tonight would be clear. The stars above would guide him. He was alive, and Century City survived. But what of his men in the far north? Would they make it back? They were resourceful and brave men. They'd make it back, somehow. With a silent prayer, he continued putting one foot in front of the other. So weary, so far to go, so very far. Independence Day warrior.
America's Zero Hour.
Adapted and directed by Dan Smith. Dialogue editing by Aaron Miller. Digital effects design by Johann Detweiler. Narrated by James Konachek. With performances by David Coyne, Terrence Azelford, Karen Carbone, Tim Carlin, Elliot Dash, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, Dylan Lynch, Michael Replogle, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Mort Shelby, Ted Stoddard, and Kate Torre. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Featuring music by Johann Detweiler and Aaron Miller. Doomsday Warrior is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1986, Ryder Sievertson. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Doomsday Warrior, be sure to look for Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist and James Axler's Deathlands. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll also find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free screensavers, desktops, ringtones, and games.